Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. In this hour of the show, of Focus, we'll be talking with one of this nation's leading political commentators. His name is Andrew Sullivan. He writes for Time. He is an essayist for Time magazine, columnist for the Sunday Times of London, senior editor at the New Republic, also editor of The Daily Dish, which is a very popular political blog, and he is often seen as political commentator on various kinds of political television shows. He's the author of a new book that we'll be talking about. His book is titled The Conservative Soul, How We Lost It, How to Get It Back. HarperCollins is the publisher of the book. And in the book, he writes that for almost all of his life, he has considered himself a conservative. However, over the past few years, particularly, he's found himself increasingly at odds with the leaders of the Republican Party and some of the most vocal spokespeople for the right. He says that they have taken things in the wrong direction, not in step with conservatism as he feels that it is, that they have talked about smaller government, but at the same time have increased the size of government. They have boosted spending. They have undercut individual liberty. He says they have substituted religion for politics, and in the process, they have damaged both. We'll get some of his ideas as we talk with Andrew Sullivan this morning in this part of the show. And, of course, people who are listening are welcome to call with questions and comments. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving, get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, people who are listening are welcome to call in. We welcome your thoughts and questions and participation in the program. If you would like to do that here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to use, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana, anywhere that signal travels. If you're listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you can use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And then locally, for Champaign-Urbana listeners, 333-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, you are certainly welcome to give us a call. Mr. Sullivan, hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks. And yourself?
Great.
Well, thanks for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
We appreciate it. Just to ask a kind of a broad, couple of broad questions first, to think back to the election that we just had, I think that there were some commentators who said that they felt that the outcome of this election had represents, in a sense, the close of the current chapter in the history of American conservatism, at least if you think about, if you go back to, say, 1994, the time that the Republicans were led by Newt Gingrich and others took control of the House, and there seemed to be at that point a real kind of conservative ascendancy. Some people had said, you know, this last phase of the conservative movement, the conservative revolution, is over, and the election tells you that. Do you think that that is true?
Well, I think that it's very hard to know when you're in the middle of these things what the turning points really are, or whether a particular moment of epiphany has occurred. I do think the last 6 years or so, in which the Republicans have held the presidency and both houses, have shown and revealed a complete absence of real conservatism in the governing party. I mean, you had public spending increased by 40%, the fastest rate of increase of public spending since FDR. You have the biggest new entitlement program, the Medicare prescription drugs program, enacted, again, the biggest increase in the welfare state since Lyndon Johnson. You have a preemptive war, again, a very radical new idea, not a very conservative idea, that was not actually conducted in a way to make it successful. In other words, not sufficient troops were sent. You have the abrogation of habeas corpus, the authorization of torture. You have a whole litany of attempts to impose social policy and social change through constitutional amendments. You have the Terry Schiavo case, the federal government intervening in a family's decision. You have a desire to amend the federal constitution to ban all civil unions or marriages for gay couples. I mean, you have a very big government interventionist, moralizing nanny state, which is not what Barry Goldwater believed in. In fact, I think it's more representative of what the left historically has believed in than the right historically has believed in.
Mm-hmm. Well, do then maybe let me ask this question about the again about the election and for those people who I think the argument is that you can't win an election if you get your supporters to vote for you. The key is you got to get the people in the middle who could go either way. And here in this particular case, a lot of people who perhaps could go either way went in the direction of the Democrats.
A lot of moderate conservatives, I think, yeah. People who consider themselves basically conservatives and Republicans voted Democrat this time because I think they felt that the governing party was corrupt, out of touch, and also out of touch with its own basic principles. Even though many of us do not actually support many of the policies of the Democratic Party, we nevertheless felt that putting some sort of check on the executive branch at this point in time was a healthy thing for the country as a whole and reflects actually real conservative values, which is dividing government, making sure it doesn't get too powerful or too big. That's always been the great emphasis of conservatism in America, defense of the individual against the government. And now it has become, the exploitation of the government at the expense of the individual.
And this is, I guess, also we should make the point. I should make the point that your criticism of the Republican Party and some of other people who would consider themselves conservatives, this is not new. You, I'm sure, angered and upset and alienated some conservatives when you actually endorsed John Kerry.
Yes, I did in 2004 for all these reasons. I mean, this is not something brand new.
Okay.
Yes, having endorsed Bush in 2000 because I just felt that he had betrayed the basic argument that conservatives are supposed to support. But I think that more and more people within the conservative movement are saying these things. More and more voters are voting on them. You have people, very high-profile people like William F. Buckley Jr. or Jeffrey Hart, the people who helped found American conservatism, say this is no longer conservative. George Will has declared that these people do not have a coherent governing philosophy. Six major conservative intellectuals wrote an article in the Washington Monthly calling for the Republicans to lose in November. So I'm no longer alone at all, and there's almost a chorus. And I think one of the things that also just penetrates this argument is the notion that conservatives are absolutely certain about everything. They know the answers to everything, and all that really is required is for government to do the right thing, and freedom will be unleashed across the world, poverty will be ended, people will love each other more. The kind of extremely grandiose claims and promises that President Bush has made in many speeches, these are not the conservative philosophy. They're not rooted in what conservatism is about, which is surely that human beings are imperfect, that we cannot achieve heaven on earth, that there are some things government cannot do, that culture is complicated, that you can't just walk into a country and invent a new democracy overnight when it's never known such a thing in its entire history. You can't lower taxes and increase spending at a phenomenal rate and think that somehow you're going to have fiscal balance. There's just reality at stake here, and I think a lot of old-style conservatives just said these people are out of touch with reality.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's interesting. I guess sometimes I think, maybe I shouldn't say this, but sometimes I think that, when you think about the spectrum of politics in the United States, we tend to think about that as if it's a line. With the people, some people are going to be all the way over on the right, some people are going to be over all the way on the left. Sometimes I think that it's not a line. Sometimes I think it's a circle, and that the two ends actually touch, and that here's where I'm going to get myself in trouble. I think that sometimes I think the people who run the extremes of the ends are actually in some respects not all that different.
I agree with you. I don't think they're that different because once they get power, they want to use the power of government to impose their view of the world. At the other end of the extreme are those of us who actually feel that we're not sure and we don't know or confident enough in our view of the world. At least we're open to revision and doubt and questioning, and let alone wanting government to impose it on anybody. The whole point of America is for government to get out the way and let individuals figure out for themselves the way they want to live their lives and take responsibility for themselves and run their own lives. That is the other end. And I think that A lot of conservatives are as uncomfortable with the politically correct left as we are with the religious right. I mean, the religious right and the PC left basically have the same. They have the same kind of ideology. They have the same conviction that they're completely right. And they have the same ease and facility with using government to impose that on other people. And a lot of us in between just don't buy that. And unfortunately, we're stuck in a two-party system where no one quite represents us. Joe Klein, the writer, laughs and jokes, says that he and I are in the same party. It's just a pity it doesn't exist. I think the sort of socially and culturally tolerant, fiscally conservative, foreign policy prudent party, unfortunately, doesn't exist in America anymore. It's, you have to pick and choose between both parties.
Well, at the same time, I wouldn't want to say, and I don't think that you would want to say, that really what politics is the these two groups at the extremes and then this sort of vast amorphous middle, because I'm sure that, that there are ways in which you defining yourself as a conservative would define yourself as being different than another person who would define himself as liberal. Who, you know, if you're to the right of center and this other guy is to the left of center, there are going to be some things that are different.
Oh, very
you.
Much so. Although there are some things that we do agree on. I mean, I think it's amazing how some old-style conservatives and some old-style liberals agree about the Bush administration. but you're right. I mean, I think there are. I'm actually not in the amorphous middle in many ways. I'm an old-style conservative in the sense that I believe in a balanced budget, regardless of the consequences. I believe in. I don't believe in hate crimes laws. I oppose affirmative action. I like low taxes. I can be quite hawkish in defense matters. So it's not like the middle is amorphous. It'd be quite clear, actually. It's just not represented firmly by either party.
We have as our guest this morning Andrew Sullivan. He is well known as a political writer and commentator, has a very popular political blog, The Daily Dish. He's a senior editor at The New Republic, columnist for the Sunday Times of London, essayist for Time Magazine, and has written for a number of other American political publications, and has also authored a number of books about politics and about his political thought. And his new book is The Conservative Soul, How We Lost It, How to Get It Back, and it's published by HarperCollins. Questions are welcome. We've got one person here all ready to go, and we certainly would welcome others. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We'll go to the nearby community of Belgium, and this is our first caller on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how this can come out. All the way through my career is voting for people. I've always heard the Republicans say that the Democrats are tax and spend. But yet here we have a Republican administration that spends but does not tax. Now, which one's worse? When you get right down to it, you build an enormous deficit fighting a foolish war that's costing us enormous quantities of money. But yet we have no way of spending for it, you know, and we're just.
Well, I think what you have is borrow and spend.
Well, exactly.
We're borrowing this money, and we're borrowing it from the Chinese mainly, and Asian banks. But you're right. This can't go on forever. I mean, but I would point this out, that the biggest problem is not the war, even though it has been way more expensive than we're advertised. It's entitlements. If you look at the long term question of our fiscal. Solvency. You have Social Security, Medicare, taking up about 3/4 of the increase. So tackling that is important. But Bush just signed a bill. You know, he just got that bill through, the Medicare prescription drug bill. He lied about how much it was going to cost, deliberately deceived the Congress. And I think that's the problem. A lot of conservatives saying, "Hold on a minute. Are we Republicans in order to enact an incredibly expensive entitlement program that we have no way of paying for?" When did that become part of conservatism?
Well, that's exactly what I'm getting at, is the fact that we are essentially bankrupting the future with these actions that this administration's doing. Even though you say the war is small potatoes, those potatoes are pretty big, you know what I mean? And they come at a dear price.
Well, there's a key number here, which is what's called the unfunded liabilities of the federal government. That's how much the federal government has currently is promising to pay out to people over the amount it feasibly can possibly bring in tax revenues. And in 2000, that number was $20 trillion. That is, the next generation and the generation after that have to pay back $20 trillion worth of debt if they were going to keep our current course. By 2004, after 4 years of the Republicans, they'd increased that to $43 trillion. They doubled the amount that the next generation is going to have to pay back. That's incredible. And it's irresponsible, I think, to slough off onto the next generation the debts that you've incurred in your own time. I mean, that's just something that's... If you talk about moral values, my feeling is that one key moral value is not to leave your kids and grandkids with the vast debt that you built up because you didn't have the courage to actually make the hard decisions.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. What do you think of the basic concept of entitlement programs like Medicare and Social Security? Is that indeed something that the government should be doing?
I don't think it should be doing it in the way it has been doing, and I think it's dated. I think that essentially the idea that every person over the age of a certain, like over 60 or 65 or whatever age we put it, is entitled to the same amount of money from the government regardless of their own financial well-being seems to me to be a very dated idea. I do think the government has a duty to provide a safety net for people if they end up in poverty and they're old and cannot afford health care or cannot afford rent or basic amenities. But I do not think the government should be paying that amount of money out to billionaires or to prosperous upper-middle-class families, that there should be some means testing of Social Security and Medicare. I think that's going to have to happen simply because we cannot afford what we have promised. So I think a basic social welfare net is important, but I don't believe in the kind of dated welfare state that we have inherited.
Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, the criticism has been made of both Republican and Democratic Congresses and presidents, and that is that, as you say, I think that they like to believe they can essentially have everything, and that they don't want to make difficult choices. They don't want to say something like, well, look, we've only got so much money. So that means that we can only spend so much money. And that
right.
means that some things we're going to have to say, okay, we'll do this, these things, but these other things we're going to say, look, we just can't do that. If we lay that out there, would you say that are there some things in fact that in some areas in which we are spending money where you would say, we really can't, I mean, maybe it would be nice, but we can't because we don't have the money and we simply shouldn't be...
As I said, giving entitlements to upper-middle-class seniors is just something we can't afford. And I think we just have to means test it. I also think that there are huge savings to be had, for example, in getting rid of corporate welfare, all the tax shelters that cost money to protect and featherbed certain industries and companies that could be gotten rid of. Agricultural subsidies could be gotten rid of. There is once you get past entitlements, just to be fiscally honest, is where the money really is. That's the money. That's where it's going to be spent. So it's going to be quite painful. But when you present people with choices, when you say, for example, to a senior and say, would you rather have the latest prescription drugs free for your use, essentially, indefinitely, or would you rather have your grandkid have a decent education, what would you choose? And if you present people with the real trade-offs involved in fiscal sanity, I think Americans are more grown up than their politicians allow them to be. I mean, I think politicians have been too cowardly. And this is where conservatives have failed. I mean, the whole point of being a conservative is to be a Grinch, is to say no. I mean, we can't afford it. It's the reality check. And when conservatives become the people who are essentially propagating myths about what we can afford, we really are in trouble. Because liberals sure won't.
Let's talk with someone else. Here's a caller in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Regarding your fiscal theory, I agree with you in part, but I have no sympathy for you. Out here on the prairie, we've got a saying that says if you... lie down with dogs, you're going to get fleas. Well, your Republicans have been in bed with Wayne LaPierre, Pat Robertson, and Rush Limbaugh, and this is what you have made since Republicans and its conservative wing have been in control. It's a good thing there's Democrats around, and that's all I have to say.
Well, that's true. Right. I should point out that I'm not actually a Republican. I've never had a partisan affiliation, and I was forced to endorse Kerry in 2004. But I think you're right. At some level, conservatism is what the Republican Party does, and I don't want to get involved in sort of semantic questions about what conservatism is or can mean. I think it's now a big enough subject to mean all sorts of things. But what you're seeing now in the wake of the election is the beginning of a real civil war within conservatism and republicanism as to what on earth this philosophy and political party is supposed to mean and stand for.
Obviously, we could assemble a group, if we got a big enough group of people together that all, if we said at the beginning the minimum was we'd get everybody to agree they were a conservative, then if we started actually asking people about what they believed, then we might begin to find that there were significant divisions.
It used to be that the conservative coalition was united by what was called the leave us alone mantra, that evangelicals and libertarians, whether they were pot smokers or Presbyterians, or small businessmen or foreign interventionists or anti-communist hawks, everybody could agree that our basic commonality was the government should leave us alone as much as possible. It should be out of our bedrooms and out of our wallets. And that was the uniting front. But when the social conservatives and the religious right really took control of the party, then they didn't leave the others alone. And what you had was a split between those of us who put liberty first and those people who put their own morality first. And I'm happy to live in a country with people who make decisions and choices that I wouldn't make, that I would personally disagree with, because I recognize their right as individuals to make the choices for themselves. The trouble with the religious right is that they don't believe that. They actually really believe the government should try and mold and shape people's own moral lives to be better than they are.
Well, what people will hear, I'm sure, when you talk about what you believe, they will understand that you identify with a kind of maybe a slightly older kind of conservatism, a kind of Barry Goldwater-ish, libertarian-ish kind of conservatism.
Yeah.
Having said that, and you have talked about your feelings about religious conservatives and how they have come to dominate the party, and that's not the kind of way that you believe. How exactly did that happen? That religious social conservatives came to be the dominant voice in the Republican Party.
Well, it's a fascinating story, isn't it? I mean, basically, what happened is that in the old Republican Party, let's say in the 1950s, the Eisenhower Republicans, had almost no real evangelical wing. But what happened in the 60s was that Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, and a huge swath of the South became disenchanted with the Democratic Party. And Richard Nixon saw an opportunity for short-term gains in appealing to those constituents. If he could pick off a few Southern states, he could succeed. And so they went into an informal alliance with the religious right and the moral majority, which they appealed to them in certain ways. And Reagan then took that one step further. But they were always then a sort of small wing of the party, but never its dominant faction. But as time went by, and as the South became more and more Republican, and as Christian figures became more and more powerful, the tilt of the party eventually shifted dramatically. So that in this last election, you see that the Republican Party is, in fact, almost entirely the party of the South. This never used to be the case. It was the Democratic Party that had the South. And so what you had then is the Republicans lost the sort of independent, libertarian, Perot-voting middle Americans in the Midwest, in key places like Ohio and Pennsylvania, and also now increasingly in, of course, they've given up on California, which is now as solidly Democratic as it used to be solidly Republican. People forget, California was Reagan state and Nixon state. It used to be always in the Republican column, no longer. And now you're beginning to see the Rocky Mountain states in this last election, particularly places like Colorado and Arizona and New Mexico, beginning to shift again back to the Democratic Party. I think because Arizona, which is Barry Goldwater's old state, just isn't that compatible with a state like Alabama. They just have very different ideas about what conservatism means and what government should do. And that's why you saw, for example, in this last election, Arizona is the first state to actually vote against an amendment to its constitution banning gay unions.
Our guest in this hour, Andrew Sullivan. He is a political writer, commentator. He's written for many different publications. He's essayist for Time magazine, columnist for the Sunday Times of London. He's a senior editor at the New Republic. Also has his own political blog, which is read by a lot of folks, The Daily Dish. He makes his home in Washington, D.C. He has a new book out that we're talking about. The title is The Conservative Soul, How We Lost It, How to Get It Back. It is published by HarperCollins. We have some other folks here who would like to join in the conversation. That's certainly welcome. If, again, we just ask people to try to be brief so we can keep the program moving, get in as many as we can. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. The next up is someone here where we are in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Now, hello. I am enjoying this conversation. I'm not conservative. I'm, quote, liberal, whatever that means. But I do appreciate the traditional conservatism of Barry Goldwater, and I do believe the current administration is violating those norms. I read a book by John Dean called Conservatives Without Conscience. Have you read that book?
I haven't, no. I have heard of it, though.
Yeah, he refers to the Bush, Rove, Cheney, Rumsfeld, conservatism as authoritarian conservatism, and views them basically as the antithetical to the traditional conservative that Barry Goldwater served as sort of an icon for. Authoritarian, I think he describes it as one who demands absolute obedience to authority at the expense of individual liberty.
Well, that's exactly my view, too. I mean, I agree with Dean about that. And there is a very basic fault line here. It's people who look at government power and get a thrill out of using it, and other people who look at government power and want to see how we can restrain it to protect our liberties. Those are two very different impulses. You see both those impulses in both parties, actually. I mean, there are some people on the left who really would love to enforce their view of a vision of utopia on the world.
Yeah, you could call them authoritarian
liberals. Yeah,
I agree with you.
There is that element, but my belief is very much no. The government is a danger, as much as a friend, and we have to be very vigilant. And what we've seen in the last few years, I mean, to remove the right of habeas corpus from American citizens, which is basically what's happened in this Military Commissions Act. Is really one of the darkest days for American liberty in a very long time. And the government has said that it has the right to name anybody in the United States an enemy combatant, whether you're a citizen or not, detain you without charges indefinitely, and potentially also subject you to what they call coercive interrogation techniques, which any other sane person would call torture.
Absolutely.
That's the end of constitutional democracy right there.
To eliminate the Great Writ is just very horrible in the United States of America. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Let's go to Atlanta, Illinois, for the next caller on our line four, toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I agree with a lot of what you say, particularly about giving up our rights, but there's one problem that I go against the grain is big government and the fact that any system in the world, whether it's our human body, whether it's a traffic circle or an interstate or whatever, as things get more and more complex in the world, whether it's the Internet and goes on, there has to be more and more rules to make it work. And as our population goes up, people interfere with each other more often because of the fact that there's more people. So our system, by that nature, has to have more and more rules, which has happened through the whole life of the country. There's more legislation, our state 1 year passed 1,700 different pieces of legislation to make things work better, maybe. You know?
Well, I think I can see how that has happened, but I don't think there's a logical connection. In some ways, the more complicated and diverse society gets, the harder it is to manage. And what happens is the government that wants to regulate every aspect of such a complex society has to get bigger and bigger and bigger. But ultimately, it will fail because the country, I mean, take simple issues like abortion or even gay marriage that are part of the social debate right now. Well, the truth is that there are many, such a diversity of views within America. I mean, from the far left to the far right on all these issues, and lots of shading in between, that it's impossible to construct a national federal policy that makes sense of it all. I think that the more people there are, the more complicated the world is, the more diverse it is, the less government should do, because the harder it is to do anything coherent, to do anything that unites the country rather than splits it in two, so that the increasing diversity and population in America should mean government retreat, not government advance.
Well, I think, you know, you're a little bit wrong there, because there's big issues like environment, which I am a conservationist, which comes from the word conservative, and I'm a devout conservationist. And big issues like environment and stuff like that, some people don't have the education to see the overall picture. And in that case, we need government to step in. We need environmental laws that are going to, you know, affect all of us.
Well,
We need to put the taxes and our money into do that. And those decisions have to be based on science.
Yes.
And we have to involve science in all these decisions that government makes.
Yeah, the environment is a classic public good that the government has to have some say on. However, I would say this, that better for government to keep its policies on the environment as simple and as clear as possible rather than engaging in massive intervention. So, for example, on the question of global warming, I think that the best thing that could be done is for the government or the local governments to simply raise taxes on gas. That would be by far the most effective way to encourage investment in alternative and renewable fuels, because it would use market mechanisms to prompt the private sector to come up with new technology, because gas would just become more expensive and others would become relatively cheaper.
Well, why not do that just on a national level instead of a local level?
Oh, you could. I would favor an increase in the gas tax. But again, that's not necessarily big government. It's a simple move that allows the market then to do the rest. And as you know, a lot of environmental policies now, quite sophisticated and subtle. It employs market mechanisms and trading permits and so on to achieve the results that we want without government being too big and too involved in every single micro decision.
Well, you bring up some good points, but, government is still going to have to take an active part in solving some of these really larger problems. You're right, these little trite problems like gay rights and abortion and stuff like that, which really don't have any long-term impact on all of us at all. You know, government should absolutely stay out of those kind of hot issue things. But these really major things that might mean the end of the planet, all governments are going to have to get involved in a high degree.
They do. Well, take Katrina, for example. I mean, there are some circumstances in which you the government has to be there. I mean, the government's role is in natural disaster cannot be replicated by private entities. But what we have at this point is a government that is busy building bridges to nowhere, pork barrel projects up its wazoo, and even planning to go to Mars, but it can't respond to a hurricane. And we lost, you know, a major American city. So I think there's also a huge shift in priorities required for the government to work as effectively as conservatives would want it to work.
And that's up to all of us to, make sure that happens.
Well, yeah, it is. It's. I mean, I was very heartened by this election, because I think a lot of sensible people in the middle just said, hold on a minute, we're not putting up with this any longer. And more, but still it was only a 40% turnout. If more people were involved and more people really had to exercise their voice, I think we would have a much more sensitive politics. I also think, by the way, that one of the big problems is gerrymandering, that in an election like this one, far more seats should have changed hands. And they didn't change hands because both parties have manipulated the system to give themselves safe seats from now until eternity. And that has to be reformed somehow as well.
And you're absolutely right. Well, thank you very much, sir.
All right. Thanks for the call. Just again to return to these two of the big hot button issues that people who like to argue about. gay marriage and abortion. Here we have a case in both of these cases where there seems to be a clash between what might call on one side transcendent moral values and on the other side the value of individual liberty.
Yeah.
Is it possible for government to mediate that conflict somehow?
I think insofar as there has to be civil laws regulating both issues. I mean, the government's already involved in handing out marriage licenses. So, for example, it can't say, I have nothing to do with this. It has to respond. Similarly with abortion, it either is legal or illegal. And unfortunately, abortion has been distorted, the issue, by the Supreme Court's ruling, which meant essentially that Americans themselves couldn't have a say in what abortion policy would be, which I think was a terrible mistake. My own solution to both problems is a very simple one, which is the only way to solve this problem is to do it on a federalist basis, in other words, state by state. The divisions are so profound and basically irresolvable that the only way to actually govern is to allow there to be enormous diversity within the United States of laws and policies on these issues. So California, for example, can have legalized gay marriage and medical marijuana and abortion on demand, but Alabama, if it wanted to, could have laws that ban all three. And I think that's the solution. That's the state's rights conservative Goldwater solution to this problem, which is simply what John McCain said, which is let the states decide, which means keep the feds out of it.
All right, let's go and talk with some other folks here. Urbana, line two is next. Hello.
Hello. It seems to me like there's a little bit of a lack of precision in your language that you're using that lends some confusion. I mean, from what you've said, it sounds to me like you're really more of a libertarian than a conservative. And in the U.S., the Republican Party traditionally in the 20th century, and Goldwater might have started leading it, they're making it more hospitable to libertarians, but it was a Tory party. That the Episcopalian Church was the Republican Party at prayer. The idea of maximizing individual liberty in the sense of that libertarians, the way you've been talking about it, wasn't really a part of the Republican Party.
I strongly disagree. I mean, I think that in the 20s and 30s, for example, conservative resistance to FDR was all about individual liberty and states' rights. That's what formulated it. And Eisenhower and the post-war republicanism simply had to accept the legacy of FDR's big federal government, but certainly didn't do much to expand it, and then tried to ratchet it back and control it. But I agree. I mean, to some extent, these labels are just labels. But I don't agree that libertarianism or small government belief has never been part of the Republican tradition. It's been very much a part of the Republican tradition. It's just been eclipsed in the last two decades by the religious right.
Well, I think another way of reading it, and I think a more accurate way of reading it, is that the traditional Tory Republican Party has been eclipsed in recent years to some degree by the Libertarian Party, and what's tearing the Republican Party apart now is the disjunct between the traditional Tory conservatives and the libertarian conservatives, and or libertarian Republicans, Tory Republicans, libertarian Republicans. And, you know, people with your ideas in Europe would find their home not in a party that's called a conservative party or some sort of Christian Democratic party, but in parties that are referred to as liberals, say in Great Britain or on the continent. And I really don't think that...
These obviously are complicated, but Thatcher, would Thatcher then be a liberal in your terminology? I mean, she was someone who ferociously cut government spending, lowered taxes, and favored individual choice, dismantled the public sector. Was she a Tory or was she a libertarian?
Well, I mean, formally she was in the Tory party, but the policies that she's known for are libertarian policies.
Right, but what I'm saying is that they, nevertheless, those policies have a strong lineage within both the British Conservative Party and, indeed, within the American Republican Party. On the continent, you're right. I think that that some liberal democratic parties, free market, free trading parties, have generally captured that particular tradition. But in American Britain, that tradition has always been part of a conservative coalition. And you're right. I mean, that coalition has really become unglued. I think it's become unglued because the certainty of the religious right has intensified. That the forces of fundamentalist religion have really grown in strength over the last decade or two, not just within Christianity but also in Islam. And my book is really a depiction of how fundamentalism as a mindset, religious fundamentalism, has emerged as the strongest influence in global culture and presents a very profound threat to individual liberty and traditional conservatism. And that therefore the fundamentalists in the Republican Party and the religious right are not just not conservatives, they're actually the darkest enemies of conservatism, and that's why this coalition cannot last.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest, political writer, commentator, Andrew Sullivan. I expect if you've seen some of the political talk shows here in the United States, you've seen him. He appears on many of them, often as a political commentator. He's senior editor at The New Republic, has a weblog, The Daily Dish, that is read by a lot of people who are interested in politics. He is also an essayist for Time and columnist for the Sunday Times of London and author of the recently published book, The Conservative Soul, How We Lost It, How to Get It Back. That's the subtitle. It is published by HarperCollins. Questions are welcome. We have time certainly for a few others. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next, we'll talk with someone in Kankakee on our toll free line right here. Hello.
Your caller wonders how, by any stretch of the imagination, a supporter of the Democratic candidate for president in 2004 could define himself as conservative. And after the guest has addressed to that, your caller has another question.
My belief in 2004 was that no, I couldn't stand John Kerry, but I felt that what Bush was doing, both in expanding government spending and government power, and in incompetently running a war, required us to make a choice. And I respect people who decided that, well, they thought Bush on the war still should be trusted. I disagreed with them. I thought the evidence was already overwhelming by 2004 that he was grotesquely botching a war in Iraq, and we needed someone else to continue that. Now, that was my judgment, but I know it was a minority judgment, but I think 2 years later it tends to hold up pretty well. Do you think that it was a conservative phenomenon? Do you think it's a conservative thing that Bush has done in Iraq?
I expect
the caller would be with you on many respects. Well, caller, you said there was another question you wanted to ask?
Yes. Are not the Democrats and the Republicans one party, only masquerading as two parties, but not one who has the best interest of the United States of America at heart, need to reject both the Democrats and the Republicans? Thank you.
All right. Well,
I think we should all be suspicious of partisan loyalty, you know, but I don't think we should give up on the system entirely. I think that what we should do, when we have the internet and other avenues, unparalleled opportunities to make our voices heard and to contribute to the debate. And I think that we should be putting pressure on either party, depending on where we fall on the spectrum, to reform itself to become more representative of the views we hold. That's what democracy is all about. Now, I understand that my view within the Republican Party is now a minority view, but it doesn't mean I can't fight for it. It doesn't mean I don't actually enjoy fighting for it. Sometimes fighting for lost causes is the real conservative calling.
I think that there were some people who would argue that, in part, the victory of the Democrats in this past election was due to a continuing effort, something that Bill Clinton started and now other Democrats like Rahm Emanuel are continuing to carry on, and that is to drag the Democratic Party closer to the center. And in fact, they would say, if you look at some of the Democrats that were elected to Congress, they're pretty conservative, and that was very deliberate. Some people would say that this lesson would not be lost on the Republicans, and so perhaps now we're coming up to a presidential contest. What we might see is a end up with candidates who would be a Democrat, who would be pretty conservative, generally speaking, and a Republican who would be, generally speaking, kind of more liberal. I mean, that is, they're going to try to
lean to that. Well, that's what we thought we were getting with Clinton and Bush, remember? I mean, with Clinton, we were told we have a conservative Democrat. With Bush, we were told you have a moderate Republican, you know, and he worked with Democrats in Texas. That was what we were sold in 2000. But sometimes the forces within each party are strong enough to prevent that kind of moderation. But I think if you look at the candidates for 08, I think the most viable ones for both parties are actually kind of centrist candidates. I think Obama and Clinton are both moderate Democrats. I think that McCain and Giuliani, who are two leading candidates, the top two in the polls, the Republicans, are also centrists and actually kind of more my type of conservative than George Bush is.
Hmm. So do you think then these, if we end up with those kind of candidates, that they're going to find it more difficult to draw distinctions between themselves and their opponents?
I think that it's going to be less about that. I think that in some ways what this election was about was the American public saying, look, we're tired of you drawing distinctions between each other. What we're interested in is finding solutions to these various issues that confront us. We're tired of you pretending you know it all on Iraq, Mr. President. Maybe it's time for you to listen to some other people. And I think the fact that we have a completely open election this time around, there's no incumbent vice president running, and you have a completely open race on both sides, means that the people are going to be looking more for substantive proposals than they are sound bites and wedge issues. And I think that whichever candidate manages to provide that will succeed.
Let's talk with someone else here. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? I've listened to you for years. You're a very interesting man. There's something very interesting about this whole thing. You were talking, this somebody earlier was talking about complexity in society. And it seems to me that when you mention fundamentalism and the fundamentalists and politically, religiously, or whatever, their answers seem to be almost oversimplified. And I was reminded of Einstein was asked once about when he was working on the grand unified theory, someone said, well, what would it look like or what would it be? And he said something to the effect that it would be simple, not simpler. And in a way, whenever I see politicians or religious, whatever, fanatics listening, they have these sort of pat answers to everything, or ideologues or ideologies and stuff. And I'm always wondering, with the complexity of our culture, and it gets more and more complex by the year, how people can buy into the, are they looking for the
well,
simple
I think
solution?
It's related, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because it's complex
that
people seek simple solutions.
Mm-hmm.
Because actually finding the actual balance in a diverse society is really hard work.
Yeah.
It requires you also submitting your own views to scrutiny,
yes,
to accepting that one can oneself be wrong, and to admitting that we don't know everything,
yeah,
and to be open to other people's points of view. Now, that, for a lot of people, is quite frightening and disorienting.
Yeah.
And I think that fundamentalism succeeds in part because in a very complex and fast-changing world with globalization, with economic strain, and with the end of the other ideologies of right and left, fundamentalist religion is the last easy answer left for people to cling on to before they're forced to just come to terms with themselves and with making their own decisions and forming their own judgments. So it really is, in some ways, the enemy of self-government, because I think it tells the individual person, you don't have to think anymore.
Yeah.
Just hand over your entire life to this doctrine or this ideology, and it will answer all your questions.
Yeah, they tried that in medieval Europe. I want to ask you one question.
They also tried in the 20th century. I mean,
yeah.
Communism and fascism
are
secular equivalents.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, when you were talking about the cost of all these elderly people, I'll be one of them maybe soon. But the point is that do you think that because we're in a medical transition where you have medicine beginning to make on the verge of some major discoveries and major solutions to a lot of medical problems, that the older system, the system is now in transition, is so costly because they can't cure a lot of things still. So they sort of like just haphazardly repair them. So they have these people live on, but they live on as damaged individuals, the cancer removals and chemotherapies are almost...
Well, health itself, you're absolutely right. Health, our whole concept of what health is and what medicine can do has changed. It used to be just preventing death and desperate illness. Now it's you can actually positively create longer lives. You can manage medical conditions indefinitely. It's an exponentially open-ended project to maintain and improve people's health, which means that if you are committed to under the old system of guaranteeing everything to everybody, you're going to end up in an open-ended spigot of financial spending, and that's what's happening. So all we have to do is figure out, you know, what's our baseline healthcare, and then let the market do the rest. That's what I would do.
We are at the point we're going to have to finish. I'm really sorry. I wish we could keep going. There are a couple of callers we can't take. My apologies. If you'd like to read more of Andrew Sullivan's thought, you could certainly look for his new book, The Conservative Soul, How We Lost It, How to Get It Back. It's published by HarperCollins. You can also look at his web blog, The Daily Dish. His work also appears a lot of other places, the Sunday Times of London, Time Magazine. He's senior editor at The New Republic. Mr. Sullivan, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.